Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Saturday, August the 22nd of 2020. And in this Word Magazine, number 173, I want to provide an overview of the life and the legacy of Jerome, who lived from about the year 331 to the year 420. Jerome is also sometimes known as Jerome of Stridon, where he was born, S-T-R-I-D-O-N. Jerome was one of the most important early Christian churchmen and scholars. And of course, one of his most significant achievements was the translation of the Bible into Latin, the so-called Latin Vulgate, later editions of which would be declared by the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent, which met from 1545 to 1563 as part of the so-called Counter-Reformation. It would be declared there to be the authoritative translation of the Bible and still held as such by the Roman Catholic Church. This is going to be more of a biographical sort of presentation. And I'm going to be relying upon a book that I read actually back in the spring. It's a book that's been around for quite a while. It's by J.N.D. Kelly, and it's titled Jerome. It's subtitled His Life, Writings, and Controversies. This was originally published in 1975, and the edition that I have is a Christian Classics reprint edition from the year 1980. And as I read through this biography, which is a really well done, very interesting biography, I would commend it to others. I also had alongside of me volume 6 of the Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, the second series titled The Principal Works of Saint Jerome. And it was really nice to be able to read through this biography by Kelly, and then when he would make reference to a letter that Jerome had written or a tract that he had written, a polemical pamphlet, on occasion I would just turn over and read that, or it has within it the prefaces to his commentaries on different works from the Bible. And so I found that to be very helpful. J.N.D. Kelly, the J.N.D. stands for John Norman Davidson Kelly. He lived from 1909 to 1997. He was an Anglican churchman and a patristic scholar who taught at Oxford, and is probably best known for his book, Early Christian Creeds. So this book, is still used as a resource to break down and understand the early Christian creeds and confessions that were formulated, again, especially in earliest Christianity when there were controversies over Christology and the doctrine of the humanity and the divinity of Christ and so forth. So again, I read this book. I took notes. I took about 16 pages worth of notes. And what I'm going to do in this episode is I'm just going to read through my notes from Kelly's, again, biography of Jerome. And I've got so much material, I think probably it's going to work better for this to be done in two parts. So I'm going to do part one now, and I'm going to take it up to the time when Jerome went to live in Bethlehem and founded a monastic community there. I'll take it up to that point, and then in the next episode, in part two, we'll take it from his arrival in Bethlehem to the time of his death. Again, why do a study, why do a biographical study of the life of Jerome? Again, first of all, he's significant in that he played a vital role in what we could call the recognition and the preservation of the texts of Scripture in his Latin translation of the Bible that was done in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. There are at least two significant things about Jerome's translation of the Bible. One of those is with respect to the Old Testament. He used as the source for his translation not the Greek Septuagint, but he used the Hebrew Masoretic text as the source for his translation of the Bible, the Old Testament, into Latin. That's not to say that his translation was always great. There are problems with the Vulgate translation of the Old Testament, but it's important that he set a standard in the West, at least, for the Hebrew being the text, the divine original, the Hebrew verity that is to be looked to, as opposed to the Septuagint, which continues to be looked to in the Christian East. And then with respect to the New Testament, the Vulgate is important because Jerome preserved in the Vulgate readings like the traditional ending of Mark and readings like the Pericope Adulterae. And again, this is late 4th century, early 5th century. It tells you what at least a significant number of Christians at that period accepted or received as scripture. That's not to say that we put total confidence in the text that Jerome used. He did not always follow what we believe is a superior text. For example, he did not include the doxology of the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6:13b, but he played an important role with the Vulgate in preserving and validating, recognizing the authenticity of much that we take today to be the traditional text of Scripture. Another reason I wanted to do this overview of the life of Jerome is that I've encountered in some of my conversations, I've heard in snippets of things that I've listened to from popular internet apologists, or a long time back in the conversation that I had online with someone like Peter Gurry, this idea that some modern people think that they are doing text criticism just like people in the ancient context did. So they're being text critics just like Origen and just like Jerome or just like Erasmus, for example. And I wanted to look at this life of Jerome in order to dispel this simplistic notion that these men, particularly in this older ancient context, were doing anything like what is known today as modern text criticism or postmodern text criticism. They were not interested in reconstructing the text in the way modern text critics since the Enlightenment, since the 19th century and beyond have attempted to do. Instead, we can see that Jerome approached the text with reverence. He approached it with a theological outlook, with an ecclesiological outlook, and he took into consideration those interests and not just merely a rational study of the extant manuscripts that were available to him in order to reconstruct some even hypothetical texts, as some modern people are now doing. So anyways, that's sort of give you a little bit of an introduction orientation to what we're going to do. I'm going to be going through my notes from J.N.D. Kelly's book, Jerome, His Life, Writings, and Controversies, and I've given you some of the reasons why I think it will be worthwhile to do this. And again, we're going to do this in two parts. Probably actually the second part is going to be quite a bit longer, because up to Bethlehem, I think I've got about 5 pages of notes, and I've got about 16 pages total. But anyways, let's start off with my notes on Kelly's biography of Jerome. So the first thing, I know I keep forestalling getting into Jerome's life, but I want to give another sort of introductory note, and that is that J.N.D. Kelly comes off in this biography, it's a really excellent biography, but he comes off expressing a lot of times some quite negative assessments of, I guess, what we could call Jerome's prickly personality. And it's just one of the most striking things as you read through this biography is you get the sense that while Kelly definitely recognizes Jerome's great importance, he doesn't hesitate along the way to offer some pretty acerbic and cutting observations on what he picks up on related to the personality of Jerome from reading his works, and in particular his polemical works. You get the sense that Kelly really doesn't in the end much like Jerome as a person. And the final chapter in this biography is an appendix, not an appendix, but an epilogue. There is actually an appendix discussing questions about the birth date of Jerome. But there's an epilogue on pages 333 to 336. And even if you didn't have the time to read the entire biography, it would be very worthwhile just to read that epilogue where he sort of sums up his views on Jerome. And he talks about the fact that although he looks at Jerome as being a great Christian scholar, he doesn't come away liking him, kind of sort of on a personal level. Let me just share a few of the barbs that J.N.D. Kelly offers in this biography. It's on page 55. He describes Jerome as self-willed and sharp-tongued, irascible to the point of morbidity. Regarding Jerome's claim to have made a copy of the Hebrew original of the Gospel of the Nazarenes at one point during his life, Kelly says this statement, quote, is open to the gravest suspicion, end quote, reflecting Jerome's, quote, tendency to exaggerate his learning in his eagerness to impress, end quote, which, quote, led him to transform into actual achievements what were at best plans or wistful hopes, end quote, page 65. And so he's pretty tough on Jerome. He says Jerome has a tendency to exaggerate his accomplishments, to exaggerate the level of his learning. And so it's a pretty rough assessment. There's some ways in which maybe Jerome is like a contemporary text scholar in that he has a tendency to exaggerate his learning in order to impress. I don't know. Maybe he's like a lot of pastors today, yours truly included. I don't know. So on with a few more of these barbs that Kelly throws out along the way. Describing a later polemical work by Jerome, Kelly says Jerome commits what he calls serious blunders and does not hesitate to twist or even suppress facts in order to press his argument home, and implies acquaintance with documents like the minutes of the famous Council of Nicaea, on which, if they ever existed at all, he is unlikely to have set eyes. That's on page 64. And that's an interesting point. He said, you know, sometimes Jerome would claim to have had access to information. And again, in one disagreement, he said that he had the minutes, the notes from the Council of Nicaea. And Kelly points out, you know, if those minutes existed, they're not extant, and it's unlikely that Jerome would have had access to them, you know, 75 years after the Council of Nicaea. And that brought to mind, I recently heard an internet apologist say something sort of similar. They were talking about the Coma Ioanneum, and they said, if it was authentic, why wasn't it cited in the Council of Nicaea? And indeed, there are some existing written canons that were produced out of some of these councils, but we're not privy to all the deliberations that took place in these councils. And so it goes all the way back to, again, the 4th and 5th centuries with Jerome, folk claiming to have more information than is actually available to make assessments like this. Kelly later on page 159 suggests that Jerome was prone to habitual exaggeration. On page 149, he says Jerome was sensitive and petty-minded. In introducing Jerome's conflicts with a person who had been a childhood friend of his named Rufinus, and we'll spend a lot of more time talking about his conflict with Rufinus probably in the second half of this two-part series, Kelly observes the following. He says, Jerome's was a much more passionate, impulsive, egotistical disposition, sensitive to the point of morbidity. That's page 195. Adding that he was, quote, intensely possessive, suspicious of, and hostile to the people who did not yield to his spell, end quote, page 196. So Kelly does not have a particularly positive view of Jerome just as a person. And so it's kind of intriguing to read a biography where the biographer doesn't really like much the person he's writing about. But Kelly's biography is an incredible treasure trove of information. It's an incredible piece of erudite scholarship and learning. And there's so much that can be gained from it. And I didn't really do any comparisons. I'm not sure, since this came out in 1975, whether there's been a biographical work on Jerome in English or in any other language that can equal what Kelly achieved with this book. The biography is appropriately subtitled Jerome's Life, Writings, and Controversies. And so he has all three of those concerns in mind. He's going to tell you about his life. He's going to describe his writings, his written works, whether they be commentaries or letters or polemical tracts. And he's going to describe the many controversies in which Jerome was involved in the course of his lifetime. So the book consists of some 28 chapters. And again, I'm going to divide this presentation into two parts. First, I'm going to discuss Jerome's early years, especially his formative years that he spent in Rome, being educated and being, we could say, Christianized. And then the second part of this biographical review is going to cover his more mature years that were spent in Bethlehem, in a monastic community in Bethlehem, where he was until the time of his death. So again, in part one, we're going to be looking at Jerome's early years, especially in Rome. And this would be roughly from the year 331 down to the year 386. I'm calling this his early years, but this would have been from his birth to when he was about 55 years of age. Of course, he lived to his early 90s, so he had a lot more gas in the tank from after age 55 to his death. And some might say some of his most significant work was done in those final years, final decades of his life. So anyways, let's talk about Jerome in the first 55 years. Kelly notes that Jerome was born in Stridon. Again, he's sometimes known as Jerome of Stridon. Stridon was a town in what the ancients called Dalmatia, the area that later became known as Yugoslavia. And Kelly says that he was almost certainly born in the year 331. And again, he has a separate appendix at the end of the book on pages 337 and 340, in which he has an extended discussion on establishing the proper birth date for Jerome. The date 331 comes from a biographical mention of Jerome in a book by a man named Prosper of Aquitaine. And it also includes the tradition that Jerome died when he was about age 90 or 91, more specifically. Some people have suggested, however, that there's a possible later date for his birth, that he wasn't as old as Prosper of Aquitaine makes out. And so there's an alternate suggestion that he wasn't born until 347, which would take 16 years off of the span of his life. But again, Kelly says he was almost certainly born in the year 331. His birth, his entry into the world, corresponded with the crumbling of Imperial Rome and the corresponding rise of early Christianity after the Diocletian persecution and alongside of the conversion, so-called, of Constantine and Christianity becoming accepted within the later Roman imperial period. Jerome came from a Christian family of some wealth. His father's name was Eusebius. This is not Eusebius of Caesarea, the church historian. Eusebius was a pretty popular name among early Christians. It means one who is devout. We do not know his mother's name. There's no record of that. His Greek name, Jerome's Greek name, it was Hieronymus. And so you'll often see it written that way, Hieronymous. And that name in Greek means sacred name, Hieronymus. And the anglicized form of it is Jerome. So if you know somebody named Jerome, their name means sacred name. At about the age of 11 or 12, he was sent to Rome, the capital city of the Roman Empire, to attend a grammar school that was led by someone named Aelius Donatus. And there's not a lot known about his early years, but apparently if you were a Roman family of some wealth and you lived out in a province like Dalmatia, it was customary to send your child off to get a good, solid education in Rome. So again, he first went to this grammar school taught by this fellow named Aelius Donatus. And then when he was about 15 or 16, he apparently went to a Roman school of rhetoric. And this is important because Jerome gets grounded in these formative years in classical Latin, classical ancient authors, classical philosophers, those who were skilled in rhetoric and so forth. And then at some point in Rome, at a date that is not known to us, probably though Kelly says when he was in his 20s, he was baptized as a Christian. And that's interesting because although later on in his life, Jerome will be an ardent advocate for infant baptism, he himself had not been baptized as an infant, though he had grown up in a Christian home. And so it's interesting, I guess, in particular from a Baptistic perspective, to see that infant baptism was not actually as widely practiced in this the time of Jerome's at the time of Jerome's birth and adolescence as will become normative, especially in the Roman Catholic or the Eastern Orthodox Church. So he becomes a Christian, I guess we could say formally, and is baptized in his early 20s. And then Kelly says there is something of a blackout period from Jerome's late 20s to his late 30s. There's like a lost decade in there. Kelly, in fact, says on page 24, a whole decade and more of his life is lost to us. And one of the things I find interesting about that is, you know, historians will acknowledge that it's not always easy to give a historical reconstruction of a person's life, even a person as important and well-known as Jerome. There are lots of gaps. We don't know his mother's name. We don't know the exact time when he became a Christian. We don't know the school that he, of rhetoric that he went to. And so there are historical limits to reconstructing the life of someone who lived in antiquity. And I might draw a learning from that is it's equally difficult to attempt to reconstruct a text from that period as well, often. And that's one of our critiques of the so-called modern reconstructionist method. So it's just a historical point. It's not easy to reconstruct biographically the life of someone who lived in antiquity, even somebody as well known as Jerome. We know then at some point that he traveled to Trier in Gaul, then to his hometown of Stridon, and then later to Aquileia in northern Italy. And then in the year, about the year 372, when he was about 40 years of age, he went east to Antioch. And part of what happened as he traveled east, he was a Westerner, we could say. Again, he had been schooled in Rome, so Latin was a major language for him. I'm not sure if he would have spoken a Dalmatian language as sort of his mother tongue, but then he would have spoken Latin. And though he ventures east, he's a linguist, he enjoys languages, and he's improving his Greek, which will be important for him to be able to translate the New Testament into Latin. At this time, he's also drawn to asceticism. The monastic tradition is developing. No matter how you feel about that, we can just acknowledge historically that monasticism is developing, and he's got an interest in this. He goes out and lives for a couple of years in the desert of Chalcis, from probably the years 374 to 375. And while he's in the desert, it's not maybe what you might imagine, somebody just being a hermit and being completely by themselves. He was busy studying. And one of the things he did during this time is he began for the first time, apparently, to learn Hebrew from an unnamed Jewish Christian that he had come into contact with. And so we can see how providentially God was developing in him a learning of Greek and also an elementary learning of Hebrew. One of the other things I just might observe here is, again, first 40 years of Jerome's life, there's really not that much significant that he accomplished. There's not that much significant that he did. We don't know a lot about those first 40 years. And that might be an encouragement to some people. They might, get into their 30s or their 40s, and they might think, what have I really accomplished? What have I really done? What kind of mark have I made? If in the providence of God, Jerome had died in 375 when he was in his early 40s, J.N.D. Kelly would never have been writing a biography of him, and he just would have been lost as one early Christian, that we have maybe a tiny trace of somewhere. But instead, the Lord had a lot for this man to do in the remainder of his years. Now, out of the desert, Jerome was very idealistic, and he had idealistic views about what it would mean to withdraw from the world and be devoted to self-denial and to prayer and to study and so forth. And apparently, Kelly tells us that he ran into some conflict out among the desert hermits that he was living among. He became rather disillusioned with them, and he left the desert to return to Antioch, where when he arrived in Antioch, he was reluctantly ordained there as a priest. And in those days, if you're familiar with the story of Augustine's life, you hear something kind of similar. It wasn't unusual to sort of press young men into service as officers in the church. This will happen later on to Jerome's younger brother, as he will be compelled to become a deacon and then to be ordained as a presbyter, or elder, or priest. And so he is made at Antioch a priest reluctantly, although Kelly says on page 58, he scarcely ever exercised the sacerdotal functions, but habitually spoke of himself as a monk. Several other things of interest happened during this period. First, Jerome, around this time, listened to lectures from the heretic Apollonius of Laodicea, who denied that Christ had a human rational soul, but that his soul had been replaced by the Logos. And we know this now as Apollinarianism. And so Jerome listened to, but did not accept the teachings of Apollinarianism. Secondly, around this time in his early 40s, he began to write. The first work that we know of that he wrote was a brief work titled The Life of Paul, the First Hermit. And it was sort of an idealized description of this otherwise little-known figure named Paul the Hermit. Then he also wrote around this time his first polemical work. And maybe that's why it's important to note that he had also listened to the lectures of Apollonius. He had an interest in listening to heretics and especially then being able to refute them. And so his first sort of polemical work was titled Altercation of a Luciferian with an Orthodox. And then a third thing to notice in this time, he had contact with a sort of pseudo-Jewish Christian sect called the Nazarenes. I already mentioned his claim to have copied the Gospel of the Nazarenes from the original Hebrew, which Kelly sort of scoffs at. But it's another example of him taking an interest in heterodox views and combating them with what he believed to be the Orthodox positions. By around the years 379 to 380, Jerome had moved once again. It's another interesting thing when you look at his life is how mobile he was. I mean, he was in Dalmatia, then he went to Rome, then he goes to Antioch, and he goes out in the desert, and he's back in Antioch, and now he goes to Constantinople. And he would have been there in Constantinople at the time when there had been a huge conflict between the Arians, those who followed the teachings of Arius, that had denied the Trinitarian view of Christ, the Son being co-equal in power and glory with the Father and the Spirit. And so the Arians had control of Constantinople, but during the time that Jerome would have been there, they would have experienced what is sometimes referred to as the triumph of Nicene Orthodoxy in Constantinople when the old Arian bishop, who was named, I don't have his name. I know that the emperor was Theodosius. He expelled the Arian bishop and replaced him with Gregory of Nazianzus, who was one of the great Trinitarian theologians. And apparently Gregory would have also had some interactions with Jerome. Jerome could look at him as something like a mentor. And so he was able to observe while he was in Constantinople the triumph of those who had an orthodox view of the doctrine of God and the doctrine of Christ over the Arians. It was at this time also that Jerome began translating Greek works into Latin. And so again, we have a divide that is developed between the Latin-speaking West and the Greek-speaking East. And there were particularly some of the earliest Christian writings had been in Greek, And Jerome, because he was becoming or had become bilingual, was able to speak both Latin and Greek, was uniquely situated to be able to translate some of these Greek writings to introduce them to people in the West. And one of the first things that he translated was Eusebius of Caesarea's chronicle, historical chronicle. And so, of course, Eusebius is best known for his ecclesiastical history, but Jerome was able to, again, render into Latin for the Western readers, the Latin West, Eusebius's historical chronicle. He also, at this time, translated a number of the works of Origen. And Origen had been a controversial theologian. He had been in Alexandria and then eventually moved to Caesarea and had a huge influence on a generation of Christian thinkers. He had combated Gnosticism, but also became controversial because some believed that he had also sort of tried to synthesize Christianity with Gnosticism, and this had led him into error. But he was widely respected, particularly as an exegete, an interpreter of scripture, a scholar of the text of the Christian scriptures. And so Jerome translated at this time a number of the works of Origen. Kelly says that he translated 37 of Origen's homilies, and he would later translate 41 more. And this is very interesting and a bit ironic because later on, we'll see in part two, Jerome would become embroiled in a huge controversy over Origen that would relate to his former friend Rufinus. And Jerome would lead the way, among others, in criticizing Origen and condemning his theology as unorthodox. But at this stage, he's an admirer of Origen, and he's translating his homilies and other writings. And in many ways, Kelly points out that we owe a debt of gratitude to Jerome because he helped preserve Origen's writings and his thought. Because later on, when Origen is condemned, his views are condemned as heretical. A lot of them are destroyed, and we don't have a lot of the original Greek sources for Origen's writings, but some of them have been preserved in translations like the ones that were done in this period by Jerome. Kelly notes that due to controversy over Origen, only 21 of his 574 homilies would come down in the original Greek. Many works are only known in Latin translation. Kelly also points out that Jerome's translation style, as was typical for the period, was often very fluid. We would say, using contemporary language, that he would often use more of a dynamic equivalent translation style as opposed to a formal correspondence, a word for word. I love this quotation from Kelly about Jerome. He says on page 77, Jerome had to be Jerome. He had to not only translate word for word, but he had to add some interpretive insights that he had. So now, already, we're up to the time when Jerome is in his early 50s. And he is described by Kelly on page 79 as an omnivorous student. He's constantly reading, he's constantly studying, he's constantly writing. And around this time, Jerome discovers what many before him and after him have discovered, that if you spend that much time focusing on reading and writing and so forth, you begin to suffer eye problems. And so Jerome began to have severe problems with his sight that will plague him for the rest of his life. Imagine for a second how productive he might have been had he lived in an era where you could have eyeglasses or corrective eye surgery or something like that. In the year 381, Jerome was sent from Constantinople with an ecclesiastical delegation to Rome. And he was sent to serve as a translator and an advisor to those who went there. While he was in Rome on this diplomatic mission, we might call it, he impressed the Roman bishop or the pope, whose name was Damasus. And Damasus saw the potential in Jerome, saw his abilities, and he is the one who commissioned Jerome while he was in Rome to produce a uniform Latin text of the Bible. Jerome, it is said, once observed that there were as many different old Latin translations as there were codices. See Kelly on page 86. So up to this time in the West, of course, in the East, they had the Greek, the same Hellenistic Koine texts that had been carried forward from the beginning and copied. In the West, Latin-speaking West, they were relying on Latin translations, and there was a so-called Old Latin, but there were many variations in the Old Latin translation, and so Damasus wanted to give stability by having a uniform Latin translation of the Bible. And so he commissioned Jerome to do this very thing. Jerome immediately began with the Gospels, and that's an interesting question. I'm guessing that even today, if there are, you know, something like Wycliffe Bible translators, if they go into a culture, I'm thinking that probably the first thing that they do, if there's a culture that doesn't have an existing translation of the Bible in their heart language, the place to begin is with the Gospels, with Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. I imagine they usually start off with something like John, and then add to it Matthew, Mark, Luke. And so you get the Gospels down first. And that's the same thing that Jerome did in his efforts to give a standardized, we could call it Latin translation. He started out working on the Gospels. And so Kelly makes this observation. This is page 87. He says, textual criticism is, of course, a modern science, and he was largely ignorant of its principles. He naturally relied on the old codices, which he found to hand. And so, okay, if you're going to make a translation of the New Testament, you know, you start with the Gospels, but then what's the next thing? What text do you start with? And so Kelly says, again, I'd like to this quotation from Kelly to be read by every modern person who wants to see Jerome as their model for what they're doing. He says he didn't know anything about text criticism as a modern science. He relied on we could say, I think, the Vulgate text that he found to hand. And he did, though, have access to some of the readings that we now know as or categorize as Alexandrian readings, the type of readings found in Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And so he followed some of those. I mentioned the fact that he didn't have the doxology of the Lord's Prayer, and that's not in Sinaiticus and Vaticanus either. But in general, again, he followed, I think, the popular text that was available to most Christians, and that would have included the traditional ending of Mark, that would have included the Pericope Adulterae. Kelly concludes on page 87 regarding Jerome and text. He says, on occasion, however, one has to admit that his choice of reading was not governed by any scientific principle at all. It appealed to him, for example, because it was to his taste doctrinally. End quote, page 87. Again, Jerome was not a modern reconstructionist text critic. He was looking at doctrine. He was looking at theology. He was looking at reception within the church, not a modern scientific enterprise. Again, Jerome starts off with the Gospels. He completed those, and he presented them to the Bishop of Rome, Damasus, in the year 384 as what Kelly calls the first installment in this larger project to translate the Bible into Latin. With his translation of the Gospels, he included a preface. He included also 10 tables or canons. These were the canons that were taken from Eusebius, the so-called Eusebian canons. Eusebius had in turn apparently borrowed this method of locating passages from an earlier scholar named Ammonius Saccas. And so he's got the preface, he's got the Eusebian canons, he's got his translation. He hands this to the Bishop of Rome and says, here's the beginning of this Latin translation. As for the rest of the New Testament, interestingly enough, Kelly says the only tenable conclusion is that Jerome, for whatever reason, abandoned the idea of revising the rest of the New Testament once he had completed the Gospels. I'm not sure what the state of the question is on this, but Kelly argues that when it comes to the New Testament, that really Jerome was only responsible for the Gospels, and that the rest of the New Testament was at least not primarily completed by him. He also notes that at this time, Jerome produced a Latin translation of from the Septuagint of the Psalter. And we can sort of see that his ideas on the Old Testament are going to take some time to percolate and develop. But at this point, he does a translation of the Psalms, not using the Hebrew, but using the Septuagint. And this is sometimes referred to as the Roman Psalter. Later on, when he works through the whole Old Testament, he will go back and work on the Psalms some more. The new translation of the Gospels that Jerome produced, you may be familiar with this, his new translation was not widely met with acclaim and acceptance by everyone. In fact, they were greeted with a howl of indignation, as Jerome himself had predicted. That's what Kelly says on page 89. And every once in a while, you'll hear some advocate for modern translations say, "Oh, you know, you people want to follow the same tradition as Jerome, but when Jerome came out with his new Latin translation, people criticized it too." That's not really relevant. The question is the underlying text, the text that's beneath the translation. But anyways, he got some criticism for his new translation of the Gospels, which he was able to weather. While he was in Rome, Jerome also became acquainted with some wealthy Roman women, Christian women. And these women became important patrons for him as he would continue the rest of his public life and his public ministry. And two of the women that he came into contact with in Rome were a woman named Marcella and another woman named Paula, as well as Paula's daughter, whose name was Eustochium. Kelly says that Jerome, this is page 91, quote, was strongly sexed, but also because of his convictions, strongly repressed as well, end quote. And he says this led him to crave female society. This is page 91. There are some points in the biography where Kelly really gets into, you know, some pretty intense psychological analysis of sometimes Jerome's sexual tensions and so forth. I'm not sure that they're always on target or appropriate, but he talks about this tendency that Jerome had to be drawn toward strong friendships with women on one hand, but on the other hand, trying to be celibate and ascetic. So anyways, he was introduced to this circle of these influential, wealthy Christian women, and he sort of became like a teacher, a sort of a Bible study leader for this circle of influential women. Jerome led in these studies what Kelly calls, quote, a campaign for an intensified asceticism. That's page 108. And so he was influencing these women, if they were widows, not to remarry. He was influencing younger women, if they were younger women, not to enter into marriage, but to remain single and celibate and give themselves to a life of prayer and to a life of poverty and a life of service. And this did not go over well with everyone in Rome, as you might imagine. And at some point, there were some unknown charges that were brought against Jerome that made a charge of him possessing a disgraceful character. No one goes out and says he did anything necessarily inappropriate, but it's never exactly identified what the charges were that were made against him. And for whatever reason, he sort of abruptly decided to leave Rome. And so over the course of the next year or so, this would have been about 385, Kelly says, when he left Rome, to the year 386, he left Rome, and again, he sets off to do some extensive traveling. Again, it's amazing in the first half of his life how much he moved about and, you know, going to, you know, the key centers of early Christianity. He's in Rome, he's in Antioch, he's in Constantinople. And so he sets out, and he's accompanied, though, when he leaves Rome, with two of these influential women, with Paula and with her daughter Eustochium. And they go with him. They visit the Christian holy sites in Palestine. They visit monasteries, places from the life of Christ. They go to Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem there is a monastic community that is led by Jerome's childhood friend Rufinus. And there, Rufinus is the leader of sort of the male monastic community, and it's side by side with a female community or convent led by a woman named Melania the Elder. And this is at the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. And so they visit there, and then they also go outside of Jerusalem to Bethlehem, to the site of the birth of Christ, where there's a church constructed, the Church of the Nativity. And so they visit all these holy sites, sort of a religious pilgrimage, religious tourism, we might call it. And they leave Palestine, and they go to Alexandria in Egypt, where there's a big Jewish and a big Christian community as well. And while they are in Alexandria, Jerome confers with a man known as Didymus the Blind. And Didymus the Blind is a famous teacher in Alexandria, and he's also known as a disciple of Origen. So here's another place where Origen sort of enters into the picture. Finally, however, Jerome and his entourage decide to return to Bethlehem, which they had visited earlier. And they came back to Bethlehem with the idea of using his friend Paula's vast resources to build their own monastic communities. And so after all the early traveling that went on in Jerome's life, in the first half of his life, the second half of his life is going to be much more geographically stable, as he's going to spend it in this Christian monastic community in Bethlehem. Well, this is going to bring part one to an end. And next time in part two, we're going to continue this survey of the life of Jerome, and we're going to pick it up from his residency in Bethlehem beginning around the year 386 to the time of his death in the year 420. I hope that this episode has been helpful and will prove useful to those who are listening, and I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.